We'll hear arguments first this morning in 1149, Carey and others against PFAS. Mr. Hoffenberg, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case is here today for determination of the right for an award of general compensatory damages in a failure to provide an adequate due process hearing where the plaintiffs neither proved any individualized injury or any pecuniary loss. The issue before this Court is whether or not the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit erred when it determined as a matter of law that general compensatory damages must be awarded for the violation of the civil rights absent some proof of individualized injury or pecuniary loss. Briefly, the record reflects the following facts. We have a consolidated matter before the Court. We have two plaintiffs, Mr. Silas Briscoe being the first. Mr. Briscoe was a student in the Chicago public school system. During the year of 1972-73, the school which he was attending was changing from a predominantly white school to that of a black school. During that time, the school officials noted that there was some gang activity in the school and around the area and some gang recruitment, and had occasion to observe that during that period, that some students were wearing earrings during that period of time, and decided on that basis, after conferring with two or three of the school officials, determined that it was necessary in the interest of safety to ban the wearing of earrings. Mr. Briscoe was on actual notice of this ban. In May of 1973, Mr. Briscoe was observed wearing an earring. He was told to remove it. He refused to remove it. His mother was called in. After extensive conversation with the district superintendent, Mr. Briscoe removed the earring and no further incident occurred. In September of 73, when school reconvened, on September 11th, Mr. Briscoe again wore the earring to school. The assistant principal and the principal instructed Mr. Briscoe to remove the earring. He denied. He would refuse to remove the earring. Mr. Briscoe's mother was called. She came in and she supported Mr. Briscoe's refusal to remove the earring, and Mr. Briscoe was suspended for 20 days for his failure to remove the earring. Mr. Briscoe served 17 days of that suspension and was voluntarily readmitted pending motion for preliminary injunction to trial district court level. Mr. Piffus was a high school student in the Chicago Public Schools, and on January 23rd of 1974, Mr. Piffus was observed on school premises with another young man outside the building, but on the school premises. He was observed by the principal smoking and passing what the principal characterized as an irregularly shaped cigarette. As the principal approached, he had occasion to observe or smell an odor what he believed to be marijuana. As he approached, the cigarette was either discarded or at some point the cigarette was discarded as he was taking the two pupils back to the disciplinary, the assistant principal was the disciplinary at the school. The two boys denied any smoking of any marijuana. They were taken back. The principal instructed the assistant principal to follow the usual procedures of the 20-day suspension. This was followed, and Mr. Piffus was suspended along with the other young man for 20 days. At some time later, subsequent to this, the district superintendent reduced the suspension, and Mr. Piffus was out of school for 8 days. The district court in this matter, sitting as a trier of fact on a stipulated record, determined that the defendants failed to provide an adequate due process hearing because he determined that these 20-day suspension triggered a need for a full evidentiary hearing. He further found that there was no good faith defense available to the defendants, although he did observe that Wood versus Strickland, in which this court determined and qualified immunity to the board members and board employees, he did observe that we don't have to predict the future of the constitutional law. And since this case arose prior to Wood versus Strickland, he said that necessarily wouldn't apply. But the doctrine of Linwood versus Peoria, a Seventh Circuit case, which said that anything over 7 days may trigger a need for a full evidentiary hearing, he said based upon that rationale, the board would not be able to have a good faith defense and, in fact, was unavailable to the board. Although he did observe that this was not that obviously the educators were upholding the integrity of the educational process. He further found that although they were entitled to damages for the violation of the deprivation of an adequate due process hearing, there was no proof of any evidence submitted, nor any evidence which would even lead to a speculative inference to form any measure of damages, and therefore he allowed no damages, and the case was dismissed. The case went up to the Circuit Court of Appeals. Strike that. There was a motion for reconsideration filed on the issue of damages. The issue of damage was reopened, and during dependency of the motion for reconsideration, the district court judge passed away. It was assigned to another district court judge. After considering the matter, the other district court judge determined that the motion must be denied in the issue of damages, and he stated the same reasons. Basically, there was no proof of any damages, and there was nothing which would lead to any speculative inference which would allow measurement as to the extent of damages, so he also denied the motion. The case went up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals on the issue of general compensatory damages, and as I indicated before, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal held that as a matter of law, the two individuals were entitled to general compensatory damages, which was inherent in the nature of the wrong, and that as a matter of law, and the measure of damages were not so small as to trivialize the right or so large as to provide a windfall. We believe that
in neither the district court nor the court of appeals was there any finding or attention given to whether the suspensions were justified?
No, the issue of liability was never a question on appeal. The main issue that was presented on appeal was the issue of damages.
I just want to know, as a matter of fact, the district court did not address the question or make any findings about the validity of the suspensions.
No, it did not. It did not reach that issue. Just determined that we violated the adequate due process.
And on remand, is there going to be any attention to it?
Well, there would be only with regard to this court on remand with regard to special damages. We did not a petition. The only regard to whether or not the suspensions were valid would be on remand with regard to the issue that was raised in the Seventh Circuit as to special damages. The Seventh Circuit held also, besides the general compensatory damages, that the plaintiffs who raised this concept of it cost $1.65 per day to educate a child and the concept that it cost, I don't remember exactly, $1.52 per day to have the student go to an out-of-city school, that was raised in the concept of a special damage, and the Seventh Circuit observed at that point that if the case was remanded to determine what validity that has as to special damages, the petitioner in this case or the defendants would be able to defend that position by showing that they would have been suspended in any event had they been afforded an adequate due process. But that was never.
Well,
we're not here.
Suppose the district court had addressed the question of the validity of the suspensions and had found that the students were properly suspended. Now, how would that change your case?
Well, of course, obviously, if they found that they were validly suspended, then the question. I don't think the issue isn't really in front of the Seventh Circuit isn't really whether the suspensions are valid.
Well, I just ask you, how would your case be changed
if
the district court had found the suspensions had been validly imposed?
Well, if they found it was valid and they still didn't prove damages, I believe it wouldn't change it because I think the Seventh Circuit dealt with it on the concept that regardless of the consequences of the suspension, we're not dealing with the suspension and its consequences, whether or not it would be justified or whether or not it was valid. The question is whether or not you're entitled to damages just for the mere proof of the proof of the violation of the deprivation of the constitutional right. That's what we're dealing with because the case, Seventh Circuit held in a prior case, which they decided.
But it would change. It might change the range of your damages, though.
Well,
special damages anyway.
Maybe special, but not as to general compensatory damages, because the Seventh Circuit really left the whole issue of whether or not the suspension was valid, they said that doesn't matter. There's something inherent in the nature of the deprivation.
But that issue, though, will be open in the district court.
Only to the regard to the special damages, not to the compensable damage, not to the general compensatory.
But it's still open. Still open.
That may be open. That's correct. The issue of the suspension, the validity of suspension, will be open as to special damages. And I think we're talking about, in that point, a total of 114 to the specials and, I don't know, $70 or $80 with regard to the other plaintiff as to special damages.
But are you telling us now, counsel, that as to the compensatory damages, it is the law of the case that it is based on this $1.65 a day?
No. Mr. Chief Justice, the law of the case, as it stands now, is regardless of, we're not here on the special damage issue. We're here on the right to recover for the general compensatory damages for that inherent in the nature of wrong, for the deprivation of the constitutional right to an adequate due process hearing. It doesn't matter. The court addressed the special issue differently, that $1.65. That's not the issue. That is something which the court tried to put a measure on some special damages, a ruler, so to speak, on terms of this $1.65. They dealt with that in terms of special damages. They say it doesn't matter. If you don't have any individualized injury, no pecuniary loss, doesn't matter. You're still entitled to general compensatory damages for the mere for the deprivation of a constitutional right.
That is the procedural constitution.
That's correct.
Mr. Hoffenberg, am I right? You didn't raise liability in the Court of Appeals.
We didn't raise liability. That's correct. We didn't contest liability.
And you are contesting it here.
No, we're not. I'm not addressing.
If I read your brief, I thought you were.
I'm not contesting liability. That's. I want to make it clear, as I argue, we're not contesting liability. There was some question as to the facts. I don't think it's necessary to get to the issue of liability. We haven't raised that issue. The main thrust of the lawsuit below was the question of our board rules. They were held to be. The court didn't reach that issue. We didn't appeal the issue of liability, and the case is strictly here on damages. Liability wasn't raised, and we are not here before this court raising the issue of liability.
So we are to take it here that the District Court and Court of Appeals were correct in deciding or assuming that these people were denied a hearing to which the Constitution entitled them.
Yes, now, an adequate due process hearing. I want to make that clear because it didn't say inadequate. The court did say it was a failure to provide an adequate. I don't think the court suggested, and I think the record will indicate, they didn't say there wasn't any hearing. They just said that there was a failure to provide an adequate due process hearing. The question is whether or not this holding of the Seventh Circuit Court or the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit is inconsistent with both the common law rules for damages and what some have commonly referred to these 42 U.S.C. 1983 actions as constitutional torts or indignitary torts. The traditional law of damages, let me start from the case. This court ruled in Monroe versus Pape in 1961 that 42 U.S.C. 1983 must be read against the background of tort liability, which makes a man responsible for the natural consequences of his actions. With that concept in mind, we believe that as long as we're going to, as long as the basis of liability for these 42 U.S.C. 1983 actions should be read against the tort liability, we should then look to the relief granted in tort law to determine what relief should be granted for violations of this 42 U.S.C. 1983 actions. As this court is well aware, the traditional law of damages on which counsel concedes, the common law rule of damages in tort liability doesn't recognize any loss other than that which is actual loss. The law has always recognized, as the Anglo-American law has always been compensation-oriented. That is, we compensate the person to the extent that money can to make that person whole, to put him in the same position when he's been injured, when he's established his legal injury, that he would have been had the deprivation not been, or the wrong not been committed. To that extent, we believe that the law regarding compensatory damages has always been that you're entitled to compensatory damages when you've established your legal injury, your fact of damage. There's a breach, there's a duty, there's a breach of that duty, there's a legal injury, and once you've established that legal injury, you're entitled to recover based upon that fact of damages. We've also recognized that just because, once you've established a fact of damage, just because it's the amount cannot be determined by any measurable standard, that amount has to be cast upon the wrongdoing defendant once you've established the fact of damage, because the court has recognized that once you've established the fact of damages, you can leave the jury to determine what value they're going to assess upon that injury.
In your reply brief, you quote from the dissenting opinion in Bigelow versus RKO. From what you've just said, I take it you accept the principle laid down by the court opinion in that case and in Story Parchment that if some damages are established, the fact that you can't put a precise dollar value on them does not mean you get no award of damages.
Yeah, we absolutely agree with that proposition. If you establish your fact of damage, if you establish your legal injury, the defendants cannot be held to say, well, these damages are speculative, therefore you're not entitled to it. We take the position that once you've established the fact of damages, just because an amount can't be placed upon it, the jury would still be left to make that determination what they want to place upon that violation or that breach of the duty.
But you say the plaintiffs here didn't even establish that.
The plaintiffs, there is no proof, and both. Remember, two district courts determined there was no proof of that in the evidence, and the Seventh Circuit.
No proof of what?
No proof of damages, and nothing which would even form any speculative inference which would lead to any measure of damages. In other words,
no proof of injury?
No proof of damages. And again, the problem we deal with is the concept of the general terms of damage and injury. If I have a duty and someone breaches, or and I breach the duty, I may be injured. But that's just a general concept. I may be damaged.
You may have injured somebody else, is what you're saying.
I'm sorry. I may have injured somebody else, and that person may have, in fact, been injured in a general sense. But that doesn't in and of itself entitle to him to relief until he's established that he has, in fact, been damaged, or he's established the fact of damage. The best example I can give you, Mr. Justice, would be in an automobile accident. If you negligently run into me, you may cause me injury. I'm injured. That's still just the fact that I'm injured doesn't entitle me to recover. I must establish as a result I broke my arm. Then the jury can determine breaking the arm, actual injury, and they can assess an intangible loss, the pain and suffering that may be attached to that actual physical loss or the tangible loss. We also recognize, and I'm going to get into that, we recognize that compensatory damages, the nature of compensatory damages are twofold. The special damage, which is to compensate the actual tangible out-of-pocket loss, and the general compensatory damages, which is to compensate the actual tangible, intangible losses, such as mental distress, such as pain and suffering, subjective pain and suffering, embarrassment, mental anguish, emotional distress. We recognize that once you've established this fact of damage, you've been humiliated, you've suffered some pain and suffering, you've suffered some type of embarrassment, then at that point, it is up to the trier of the fact to determine what amount they want to assess against the defendant once they've established that fact of damage, that intangible loss. The tort liability or the tort rules of damages in tort law have recognized that where there is no actual or legal injury, there shall be no recover. However, the common law has recognized, and I think this Court is well aware, and I think based upon the decisions in the petition for certiorari and the amicus, all the circuits, I shouldn't say all, many of the circuits, the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the tenth, have recognized that where there is an invasion of some paramount right and you haven't established any actual or real injury, you're entitled to nominal damages. A recognition of this, just of the violation of the right, setting up this person, setting up the rights of the parties, and recognize that in that situation, when you haven't established any damages, you may, a trier of fact, may award nominal damages.
Now, that rule is contrary, is it not, to the common law where at contract, if you proved a breach of contract, you're entitled to nominal damages, but in tort, negligence, the existence of damages was part of your claim for relief, and even if you could show a wrong, if you couldn't show damage, you weren't entitled to nominal damages.
That's correct, but the law has developed in the circuits and in the lower courts, in the district courts, after the Monroe case,
constitutional torts.
Constitutional torts. After Monroe, 1944, I believe there was something like 23 cases filed in the district courts for violations of 42 U.S.C. 1983. In 1961, right prior to the case of Monroe versus Pape, what this court decided, there was something like 283 cases filed. In 1972, there were something like 8,000 cases filed under 42 U.S.C. 1983. And in 1976, there were something like over 16,000. And during that, the reason I bring this up is during that transitional period, the courts, the lower courts and the Court of Appeals for the circuit started recognizing the right to recover for this intangible loss. Also, they also recognized the right to recover nominal damages. You may recover nominal damages when you've established a breach of the constitutional right or the constitutional tort. The Seventh Circuit, the question also turns around whether the Seventh Circuit created a new relief. Our position is the Seventh Circuit created a new relief for the violation of 42 U.S.C. 1983, which had not been previously recognized in our compensation-oriented Anglo-American law.
Something called general damages was known to the common law, wasn't
it? That's correct. I think that in order to make a determination here, we have to break them up in terms of general and special before this court. We have to determine what...
Punitive is not here in this case.
No, the court said there is both courses is non-punitive.
But then we have special and general.
That's correct.
And you say there was no proof of any special damage here.
Well...
With
Perhaps there was.
That's correct. We don't know. The district court determined there was no proof of any damages. The Seventh Circuit said there was also some indication that it should go back on special. That's not here, though.
But that's not here.
We're here on the general concept of the general.
And the concept of general damages was familiar to the common law, wasn't it?
That's correct. Absolutely.
And what did it mean?
General damages meant a loss for this intangible. It's something that you can't put a monetary value. This general loss, something you don't have, not out of pocket, not
right.
Something which you can
and
put
it was
in.
More than nominal, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't inevitably limited to nominal.
No, it wasn't. No. If you prove your factor damage, then if you prove that humiliation, if you prove that pain and suffering, you're entitled to recompense for that.
And you didn't have to first prove the broken arm either, did you?
Well, I think you did in terms of establishing more than just the general injury. If you establish a deprivation of any right, if you're negligent, if you negligently breach a duty, which you owe to me, I have to establish some type of fact of damage. I can't just, again, the courts have recognized, in common law courts have recognized that you just can't let juries speculate just informed of these violations.
What does general damages mean in the common law?
General damages mean a right to recover, as I see
money,
it,
money
damages,
money award,
for a violation of some right or duty owed, where you've established some type of injury
right.
as a result.
And isn't that really all that the Court of Appeals did here?
No, it went farther because it said it left out that fact of damage. It presumed some type of fact of damage just from the mere deprivation of the constitutional right. It went farther than said. The Court of Appeals said you establish a deprivation of a right. There must be some injury here. But, it's a generalized injury. It hasn't established that, in fact, these plaintiffs have been injured. All it did was, there must be some injury which is inherent in the nature of the wrong. It didn't focus on the individual loss or the fact of damage to that plaintiff. I think that...
Mr. Hoffenberg, would this case be different if the issue were a denial of either, to give you one example, a right to vote, or secondly, if there were a deprivation of the right to be free of an illegal search, and say someone had been searched, but no mental suffering in either case, just the bare injury. Would it be the same issue? And if so, how would you decide those cases?
Well, I think it would be the same issue. I think that the courts, and I think that you're in my briefs and in counsel's brief, does refer to the voting right cases and the search and seizure cases. Many of the search and seizure cases all hold, as far as we're concerned, or most of them hold, where there's a deprivation of an invasion of a search and seizure or a violation of the Fourth Amendment pursuant to 14th Amendment, that you're entitled, again, to show any type of actual damage. I think once you've established the actual damage, you're entitled to relief. If you haven't established the mere deprivation of an invasion of the right to be free from the search.
In a voting case, how would you ever have actual damage?
Well, in the voting right cases, I think that the actual damage is, again, the intangible loss. I suggest two things about the voting right cases that plaintiff has cited. First of all, that we're talking about, many of the courts, the lower courts and the circuits, deal with these voting right cases. The one that they deal with most of all is the case of Wayne versus Venerable. And that one says damages are presumed from the deprivation. But we look at that case. That case is a conspiracy case. That case goes beyond the mere negligence. It goes to willful. Also, that case was decided by the Eighth Circuit in 1919.
But what difference does willfulness make if you're not doing it on a punitive theory?
Well, that's the point. That's why I'm suggesting that if it's not punitive, we have a different concept. If it's punitive, and many states have recognized you're not entitled to recover for deprivation of a voting right case, the majority of states now take the position that you're not entitled to a right to recover for a deprivation of a voting right unless you establish actual malice or in some evil intent. As far as the Wayne case, I believe, if the court looks at that case, it says you're entitled to presumed damages even though you haven't shown any tangible loss, any monetary loss. I think it suggests two things. Number one, the idea that you don't have to show any actual damages to recover punitive damages, the idea that was established in Batista versus Ware, a Third Circuit case. And also, I think it started to recognize, as I indicated before, this right to recover for this intangible loss. You don't have to prove that you've been out of pocket, that you've had any tangible loss. You have a right to recover for this intangible loss. I think I'd like to address myself also to public
what
policy.
What loss is there by not being permitted to wear an earring? You don't have the slightest idea what that means to the person, do you?
If it does, Justice Marsh.
Well, shouldn't we have a trial and find out?
If he was injured because he was wearing an earring and he was deprived of something, if he testifies he was injured as a result of that, then he may be entitled to. Maybe there's injury. Mm-hmm. I'm suggesting that maybe there's some injury there. There may very well be, but on the other hand...
Wouldn't that show up when he's trying?
If he testifies to it, of course, and it's not here. There is nothing to establish. There's nothing to establish that he's in fact been injured. This court recognized, I believe, in the case of in the dissent.
Well, I think a man has a right to wear whatever he wants to wear.
Well, if he's injured as a result of not being able to wear the earring, if he's injured, then he's entitled to be compensated.
Well, you don't agree that he is.
Not in these facts. Not in this record.
Well, how about the Tinker case about the armband? Was it that little boy injured?
I don't recall exactly what the relief was granted in that case, the armband case.
The Tinker case,
they talked about material and substantial disruption. You have to show that there's some material and substantial.
But I'm just saying.
But
when
in that
people
case,
are denied the right to wear the clothing that they want to wear or the jewelry that they want to wear,
but
they are being denied something.
But just being denied doesn't mean that ipso facto he's been injured.
Well, and Mr. Hoffenberg, maybe I misunderstood this. I didn't think that the damage here was the denial of the right to wear the earring, or
that's
the denial of the privilege of smoking. On the other hand,
I was going to get to that.
But
point.
Rather, the denial of procedural due process.
That's exactly what the point
and
is.
And even if that had been accorded, he might have been deprived of his right to wear the earring.
That's correct.
Of his privilege to wear the earring.
That is absolutely correct. The First Amendment right was never reached, and in fact, the court just talked about the adequate due process right.
It's the denial of procedural due process. Isn't
that's
it?
Absolutely.
It has nothing to do with the.
It was never reached. The First Amendment.
Deprivation, vel non, of the privilege of wearing the earring.
It was never reached.
Or the deprivation of the privilege of
that's correct.
Smoking tobacco
that's correct.
Or marijuana or whatever it was.
That is absolutely correct.
Well, why do we have all the discussion about general and punitive and all other kind of damages?
The wrong is the deprivation of procedural
that's
due
correct.
Process.
That is what the
is
wrong
is. Is that your answer?
No, my answer to your question is
well, that's what I was trying to hear.
The answer to your question in terms of why we talk about general and special, we believe that the laws available under the concept of the tort. General rules of damages allowable in tort law are enough to compensate the person for a deprivation of this right. But he's got to establish some injury. He's got to establish some fact of damage for the denial of some right.
Before?
Before he's entitled to recover damages. I'd like to address myself in the time I have left to a question of public policy also, which should be considered here. And the question before the court is also whether the court should adopt this new relief faced with this. When the court faced with this question, we have to balance the interest here, and I think we should look to the prior decisions in this court in Wood versus Strickland and Gosby Lopez, the right to due process for the suspension and also the qualified immunity. And I think it's clear that the majority opinion in the Wood case suggests, the majority opinion in the Wood case suggests that we really should leave management of schools to the school districts. We really should leave the school districts alone to run their schools, and we really should be in a position not to deter qualified people from becoming board members, from becoming board personnel, and we shouldn't impose.
Mr. Hoffenberger, if I could interrupt, this
yes.
argument goes to the procedural due process, the policy involved there, but if I understand your earlier statements, the same problem involved is raised when you get a Fourth Amendment question or a right
that's
to vote
correct.
Question where you don't have school boards at all.
That's correct. And
so
I think
so we should the school board policy cut across the whole spectrum of constitutional rights?
Yes, I think so, because again, even in Fourth Amendment rights situations, the concept of having these police thwarted with this concept of not being able to, I don't want to deal very much. I know this court is dealing with the exclusionary rule. I don't want to deal as much with the Fourth Amendment, but I do want to point out that where there's a deprivation of Fourth Amendment right, there are policy considerations there, whether or not you're going to not allow police officers or you're going to require police officers to almost look towards what they're doing if there's a later determination that what they did, even if it was negligent, cause some deprivation, even if it was negligently. And you have to look for the deterrent effect of the police officers, as we do to the deterrent effect here, whether or not we should deter the police officers, whether we should deter the board of members, qualified board members, whether we should deter their duties, as opposed to the possible benefits that would accrue to the plaintiffs in this matter.
This case comes to us, as I understand what you earlier said, that there was a violation of procedural due process, and that and any good faith defense is out of the case.
That's correct. We're dealing
well,
with
then, so you're saying there was a knowing violation of the procedural due process, and well, that's the way the case comes to us.
Well, I believe I want
isn't
to extend.
It or not?
Yes,
right.
But I want to extend that idea of the immunity also to this policy consideration.
Well,
and
not
I,
for that.
Excuse
not
me.
For, not for a knowing violation.
But it's, when you say knowing, it's constructive knowledge situation. You should have known. In this case, observe that in dissent, this case, in the case of Goss versus Lopez, this concept of should have known deals with. You should have known that you violate constitutional rights. Deal with the known constitutional law. And as the dissent says, knowing constitutional law. It's a 5-4 decision. Look how close it is, and we're talking about knowing with constitutional law. In conclusion, I'd like to point out that we should leave the operation to the schools, to the school districts. We should also leave the possibility that money will be taken out of taxpayers' hands if they're indemnified. The taxpayers will have to pay for it as weighed against the probability of some damages, speculative damages, one far outweighs the other one. Thank you very much.
Mr. Elson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. First, it's important to point out that petitioner's argument is directed against only one of the Seventh Circuit's four grounds for reversing the district court, as now is very clear. The petitioners have not argued that it was error for the Seventh Circuit to reverse the district court for its failure to grant declaratory or injunctive relief, or for its failure to consider the evidence that was in the record, which quantified respondents' injuries from being wrongfully denied educational services for 8 and 17 days of school. Therefore, regardless of how this court feels about the question raised on this petition, it will be necessary to remand this case in order that the district court can enter the appropriate declaratory injunctive relief and can determine the damages which are appropriate for the wrongful deprivation of respondents' educational services.
Now, you're going beyond the damages for the denial of a hearing, the due process violation.
Yes.
And you say that there are two elements of damages now to be determined, one for the denial of the hearing and the other for the loss of the schooling.
Right.
Exactly. That's in the district court, but not here.
That's in the district court, and I was just clarifying that that is not here, and that is not before this court, so this case will have to be remanded back to the district court for a determination of those damages, regardless of how this court determines the issue raised on the petition. In view of petitioner's statement of facts in their briefs and partly here, I think it's necessary to clarify that certain findings of the district court are not an issue before this court. First, as now is crystal clear, there's no question that the petitioners have violated due process and that they're liable for damages under would be Strickland. And second, despite the petitioners' characterizations of the respondents, there's no basis for disputing the district court's findings that the respondents always denied the wrongdoing with which they were charged and that they were never given an adjudicatory hearing of any type. And the district court was clear on that point, said specifically they're never given any adjudicatory hearing.
Mr. Elson, I perhaps shouldn't interrupt on this point, but you say it's clear they're entitled to damages. That's not what I understand. It's clear that they're entitled to a hearing at which the school board may offer evidence that they would have been suspended even had they been given a fair hearing. Then there would have been no actual damage.
Yes, the Court of Appeals remanded for a determination of possible consequential injuries. The Court of Appeals stated that if the school board chose at that time before the district court to show that they were in fact guilty of what they were charged with, then they don't get compensatory damages.
And then your client will recover nothing unless you prevail on the theory that's in dispute here.
That's correct.
Which is what?
What the dispute is here?
No, what is your theory here?
Well, our theory is that it's incorrect, as petitioners do, to equate the remedies that are appropriate for constitutional violations with the remedies that are appropriate in breach of contract cases and technical trespass cases. Now, in those cases, as petitioners correctly stated, you cannot presume damages injury from the violation of the right itself. You have to have independent evidence of the injury.
You mean harm? I mean,
of the harm.
Some deprivation of some tangible loss?
Right, like walking across someone's grass would not be a tangible loss in that. You'd have something else for a technical trespass.
Well, what if it hurt your feelings? That's not the kind you're talking about?
No, those are the types of injuries we're talking about that can be presumed from the violation, where the interests which are protected by the right are of an intangible nature, such as liberty, privacy, reputation, peace of mind, dignity. The violation of the rights in those cases proximately and necessarily cause a injury to those intangible interests. And it's black-letter law that in cases of invasions of privacy, libel and slander per se, false imprisonment and false arrest, that harm is presumed from the very violation itself and no independent evidence of injury is required. You can show such independent evidence of injury in order to increase your damages, but the cases are clear. You don't have to show those that type of independent evidence. And many courts have recognized that exactly the same types of intangible interests that are at stake and that are violated in these common law tort categories are also injured in the violation of civil rights. And
let
petitioners.
Let me test that out a little
agreed.
Bit, see
yes.
if I understand you. On your illustration of claim injury and damages for someone walking across your lawn, if the plaintiff showed merely that the defendant had walked across his lawn and no more, that might justify a jury verdict of $1 or 25 cents, would
yes.
you agree?
Yes.
But if it went very much beyond that, do you think it, without any other evidence, would you think it would be sustainable?
If there were a showing of the actual...
No, just that he walked across the grass.
No
showing that the grass was injured or that the grass died or anything else. Just walked across the grass and a jury returned a verdict of $10,000. What would you think an appellate court would do on review?
I think an appellate court would reverse and find that that award was not justified by the showing of injury. There are some early, very early common law tort cases when this theory was being worked out that did say that for the trespass alone you can get, for the violation you can get damages, but that is not the law now. It's fairly clear. The petitioners agree with the many cases that show, that state, that intangible injuries are caused by violation of civil rights. And the rationale for presuming damages from the violation of the right in these civil rights cases is exactly the same as the rationale for presuming damages in these common law intangible injury tort cases that I mentioned.
Mr. Elson, why is it not certain that a 20-day suspension is damaging when you're denied your education for 20 days, period?
To us, it's very certain that that is a very serious injury.
But that isn't the issue.
It's not the issue here.
Well, that's my whole point. That's not it.
That's not in this case because they have not raised that as an issue.
When you say civil rights, do you mean any right that is protected by the Constitution?
Yes.
So that, for example, if in violation of Article 1, a state official laid a tax or duty on articles exported from any state.
I misspoke. I'm talking about the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment.
And why do you limit it to those?
Because with respect to those constitutional rights, there may be other constitutional rights. I haven't given the thought to the whole Constitution. But with respect to those rights, intangible injury can be presumed from the violation itself because they were intended to protect important tangible interests, and you cannot violate those rights without harming those interests.
Well, why do you presume that with respect to this particular category that you've delineated and not with respect to the rest of the Constitution?
Well, I suppose there would be certain types of rights where you just can't presume any injury. Within the Bill of Rights, an Eighth Amendment violation could not be presumed because, in fact, there you have to have a showing of serious, tangible types of injury. And I suppose the same might be true with the Interstate Commerce Clause. I'm not really sure. I haven't...
Well, what's the principle that enables you to distinguish one from the other?
The principle is that if the right in itself is inseparable from important intangible interests. For example, if a school should make a public a student say a prayer against his religion, then that violates his First Amendment freedom to pray according to the dictates of his religion. And that in itself is an interest protected by the First Amendment. Or an intangible search is an example that Mr. Justice Harlan gave in his concurrence in Monroe of an unconstitutional search, in which the interest invaded there is the interest of being secure in your home against arbitrary governmental invasion. And that is the essence of the Fourth Amendment. Or in this case...
Does that include all the freedoms protected by the Second and Third?
I think it very well might.
Eighth and Ninth.
Well, Eighth
and
is
tenth.
A different question.
Well, but you don't include the Eighth?
I wouldn't think you could in the presumed damage because it's fairly clear that in order to reach an Eighth Amendment standard, you would have to make a showing of fairly serious harm
so
to the person.
So it includes some of the rights and freedoms
yes.
protected by the Bill
yes.
of Rights, but not all.
Not necessarily.
And probably not any of the other protections of the Constitution. Is that it?
Well, not necessarily. You would have to look at the right and see whether it protects some intangible interest.
The Constitution is a written, organic structure of the government of our society, and it's presumably it protects us all.
Yes.
In every one of its provisions. And how are you picking and choosing? I'm interested in...
Well, I don't believe that it would be appropriate for this court to pick and choose and say certain rights.
Well, how
rights
are you? But you are, aren't you?
I'm not picking and choosing now. I'm just saying why I think that injury should be presumed from the violation of the right itself, inevitably.
Some of the provisions of the Constitution, but not all.
Well, possibly all. I certainly...
But you say
wouldn't.
Not the Eighth Amendment.
I think it would be difficult because you already have to show objective proof of injury in order to qualify for an Eighth Amendment violation. So there would be no need to presume damages.
Denial of a speedy trial?
Yes, certainly.
Or the right to counsel? Or
definitely.
Well, but what about, say, denial of a jury trial? He claims that jury trials and rights being violated and... He's convicted, he appeals, and it's reversed. It's saying that he was entitled to a jury trial in the circumstances of the case. Then he brings a 1983 action and recovers damages?
Well, certainly at the time that he was denied his right to a jury trial, he did suffer a loss. He was treated unlike other citizens with these civil rights. I mean, possibly if the jury trial didn't make any difference, the damages certainly wouldn't be enormous, wouldn't be that great. But he did suffer a loss in that he suffered certainly the indignity of not having his right to a jury trial.
Well, doesn't he have a tangible loss there? Presumably on appeal, on this hypothesis, a new trial would be ordered because of the denial, and you have one tangible measure of damages, namely the cost of the first irregular trial. Suppose he could show that he'd spent $4,000 in attorney's fees and lost 11 days of work. Wouldn't that be specific?
Yes.
Damages showable under the special damage factor?
Yes, that would be one measure of his loss.
And then he might get some general damages for the intangible, is that
yes.
it?
Yes, that's right.
Mr. Elson, may I ask you a question? I may have trouble articulating this. I'm having some conceptual difficulty with your proposition. The right here to a fair hearing is not something that exists all by itself. There's no constitutional right to due process, period. There's a constitutional right not to be deprived of liberty or property without due process.
That's right.
So an essential ingredient of the constitutional violation is harm to either liberty or property. Why should not the harm to the liberty or property interest always be the measure of damages for the violation of the due process right? In other words, why won't your injury be that which is not before us rather than that which is before us?
Because according to the rationale of the Seventh Circuit, and which we, of course, agree, there is a separate type of injury from being deprived of the right itself.
But that assumes that there's a separate right to a hearing apart from
protection
against some injury.
There is no injury, and the injury from the right is not triggered until there is some
deprivation
of a protected liberty or property interest.
Well, why shouldn't that measure the magnitude of the harm?
Well, because that is a separate type of injury, and sometimes that will not be available, for instance, in the employment cases.
But if that's not available, if that's zero, what is the constitutional violation? If that's zero, then there's not been any deprivation of liberty or property without due process of law.
There has been at the time that the violation occurred. There's certainly a right was taken away without, these interests were taken away without giving these procedural rights. Now, if it turns out later that, in fact, the government official was justified in taking away those rights, then he is not entitled to the damages because it was not unfair. He didn't really lose anything by the deprivation of the right.
Well, was he deprived of liberty without due process of law?
He was at the time of the deprivation.
I still don't see why, if that is true, why that isn't an adequate measure of his damages.
Well, maybe if I can put an example of, say, a prisoner who is in prison, say, for 5 years by a jailer without being brought before a judge, and it subsequently turns out that, say, his 1983 suit, that the jailer can show he was guilty of the crime and he would have been sentenced to the mandatory minimum 5-year sentence. According to the rationale of no presumed injury, it would be as if the right to a trial did not exist. It would be as if he was not deprived of anything, when this is one of the most fundamental of our constitutional rights.
Well, many rights are not necessarily protected by the award of monetary damages. They're protected in other ways. Their trial errors of constitutional magnitude are protected by a reversal by a reviewing court, for example, not necessarily by the award of money damages. Not every right is compensable and is protected by that particular sanction,
no,
is it?
Not necessarily. However, where there is a loss, then damages are the traditional common law remedy in order to remedy that loss.
In addition to the new trial that's ordered.
Yes. Well, they can be. Where it's just, it's the common law principle.
I took your answer to mean that whenever a new trial is ordered because of trial error, that in addition to being compensated by getting a new trial, which is the traditional remedy for that wrong, there's also a 1983 claim for damages.
No, certainly not necessarily.
Well, I thought
that there would have to be a showing that the violation of his right was knowing or negligent, or that he should have been, the official should have known that he was violating the right. And certainly if it were done by a judicial officer with absolute immunity, or even a state's attorney, so it would be very unlikely that that would actually happen.
But that's just because of the immunity of a particular defendant. It's not because the right in
yes, there's a real loss. There may be
somewhere
there may be a real loss. And as I think, believe there is a real loss when somebody's deprived of a right to a trial.
Or the right, say, to be indicted before you can be charged, before you can be tried on a criminal offense in a federal court. That's a constitutional right.
Yes, possibly.
And if you haven't waived it, then you have a right of action if you've been tried as a result of an information, not an indictment.
Yes.
For monetary damages.
Possibly, if all the requirements have been met. In further response to Mr. Justice Stevens' question, another measure, another reason for the injury suffered by the deprivation of due process is the lost opportunity to make your case to the initial trier of fact. And that is something different from the deprivation of the interest itself. And that's something you can never know at that time what the opportunity to make your case to the discretionary judgment of the initial trier of fact would have availed. So even if it's determined later.
I understand why a denial of a fair hearing can cause harm.
Yes.
I'm not questioning that proposition. But I still must confess to some uncertainty about your response to the 5-year jailer case. Even though you assume the jailer holds a man for 5 years without due process of law, I would suggest, well, that measures the value of 5 years imprisonment is the measure of damages for that deprivation of a constitutional right. Then you say, well, but maybe later on he'll be tried and convicted. Well, that still doesn't seem to me to detract from the proposition that the measure of the harm was that he was deprived of his liberty for 5 years without any constitutional protection. That still is the measure of the damage for that constitutional wrong.
Well, that may be
and
one...
Which in this case would mean the 8 or 12 days, whatever the children are out of school, would be the measure of damages here.
That may be one measure, but it would be a very drastic penalty on our government to make them pay for 5 years imprisonment that should have been served and would have been served had due process not been violated. In this sense, the Seventh Circuit...
Well, but the protection against that normally is the judge gets immunity and there are all sorts of defenses. The damages aren't awarded automatically in these cases.
No, that's correct. But in the rationale of an employment case where those immunities would not occur, if someone was deprived of employment or without a hearing, and it turns out that there was all sorts of cause to get rid of that person, and the person's out, say, for 10 years or something, under that rationale, those injuries being the only measure of damage, the damages would be tremendous for an employee who should have been fired. And the Seventh Circuit's position really is kind of a middle way between that. It just gives damages for the actual harm suffered by the deprivation of the right.
Well, let me put this case to you. Supposing in this case they had they brought the student before the principal and had some summary procedures that were clearly unfair. They quizzed him one way or another, but then they didn't suspend him. You wouldn't have any claim then, would you?
No, none at all, because there was no protected liberty or property interest that was violated.
So there must be harm in the sense of loss of property or liberty before the deprivation of a fair hearing has any constitutional significance.
Definitely. It triggers the harm.
Well, on that basis, if it's determined now, in this case, that there never was a violation
in the sense that the suspensions were proper. No, there was no deprivation of liberty.
That's right.
If that's determined, does that end the case?
Yes, if there was no due process violation in the first
place. No. There was a. It is. Let's assume on remand in the district court is determined that the suspensions were quite proper. There weren't any procedures, but nevertheless, the suspensions were quite proper.
Yes.
In that event, there's been no deprivation of of a liberty.
Yes, there has.
No.
Well, there's been no deprivation of the right to stay in school.
No.
That's right. That would be our position. That's what the Seventh Circuit said. But the Seventh Circuit said, nevertheless, since there was a deprivation of due process at the time, you were deprived of something.
Yes, I understand, but you were deprived of your chance to have a hearing.
Right. And that in itself is
You think that is compensable?
Yes, that in itself
is that inconsistent with the answer you gave to Mr. Justice Stevens?
I don't believe it was.
Yes, all right.
Possible.
Even though the injury to the liberty is zero, the right to stay in school, the thing that triggered your right to a due process hearing, even if it's determined that invasion was zero, you say that you're entitled to damages.
Yes, if it was later determined that it was zero, because at the time you were deprived of your interest in having a hearing and making your case to the initial decision maker, besides the indignity and the that was suffered. Given that the constitutional rights, our position, cannot be separated from the intangible interests which those rights are intended to protect, it is not surprising that the common law has long recognized that the damages may be presumed from the violation of civil rights themselves. There are no special remedial rules for civil rights cases which exempt them from this normal rule that damages should be presumed where intangible injuries are the natural and proximate result of the violation. And since 1703, in the English voting rights case of Ashby versus White, the common law has recognized the principle that every injury to a right imports a damage. And Mr. Justice Holmes relied on this principle in Nixon versus Herndon. In that case, held that a valid claim for substantial damages were stated when the only harm alleged was the deprivation of equal protection, which arose out of the denial of the right to vote on the basis of race. I think our brief incorrectly described that as a voting rights case, when in fact it's an equal protection case. And there are also many other American voting rights cases that recognize this principle. Now, petitioner's argument is not only contrary to these common law cases, it's also contrary to congressional intent that courts apply the most effective remedies that are available for the purpose of deterring violations of constitutional rights. It is clear from the congressional debates and from many opinions of this court that the primary purpose of Congress in enacting the Ku Klux Act of 1871 was to deter constitutional rights violations. And in Section 1988 of Title 42, Congress gave the courts specific direction as to how they were to apply remedial principles under the civil rights laws in order to achieve that deterrent purpose. And as this court stated in Sullivan versus Little Hunting Park, courts were to use whichever federal and state rules on damages would better serve the policies of the federal statutes. Now, the technical trespass damage rules proposed by petitioners would obviously be less effective in deterring civil rights violations than the damage rules in the voting rights cases and these intangible injury cases in Nixon versus Herndon. A rule that required independent proof of injury for the award of damages for civil rights violations would give officials absolute immunity from damages where the nature of the constitutional right is such, or the circumstances of a violation are such, that affirmatively provable injury is unlikely to result from the violation. Examples of the First Amendment cases are due process. And it is exactly such absolute immunity the petitioners are asking for in their reply brief on page 28, where they query whether, as a result of the Seventh Circuit's decision, educators would have to think about, or they say research, their own discretionary acts in terms of the possibility that a court might find them liable in damages for violating a person's civil rights. But it was precisely to force officials to give consideration to avoiding constitutional rights that this court rejected educators' claims of absolute immunity in Wood versus Strickland. There is nothing about the particular type of compensatory damages awarded for the deprivation of civil rights which is relevant to whether educators should be allowed to violate constitutional rights free of any concern for their accountability under the civil rights laws. The rationale of Wood requires that public officials not be given such a zone of immunity for their constitutional violations where the interests protected by the rights are of such an intangible, unquantifiable nature.
Well, what if the plaintiff is in a civil suit is cross-examined on stand and you ask him about his damages? Did it hurt your feelings? Or you ask about all the intangible things you can think of, and he says, no, I didn't. But I'm still entitled to some damages because I think you ought to be deterred from violating my rights.
Well, in that case, such evidence certainly would go toward reducing and mitigation of the damages.
Well, but to zero or not?
No, not to zero.
So you do espouse openly and frankly you must give some money, some substantial award to deter.
Well, I would point out that is not this case. There is no evidence in this case, but yes, I would say that the intent of Congress
and
is
your intent
that,
and your submission
is that the most effective remedies available in the common law are to be used, and the presumption of damages from the violation itself is a remedy that is traditional to the common law and should be used in these cases.
So you don't think damages are limited to what a jury or a judge might think the intangible injuries to the plaintiff are?
No, certainly they're limited to that, but with the instruction as
the
Seventh
Circuit. You say they are limited to that?
No. With the instruction that the damages be not so small, as the Seventh Circuit said, to trivialize the right. Now,
yes, but
a nominal
I pose to you the case where the plaintiff frankly concedes, as far as I know, I've had no intangible injury. I just think that I ought to have some damages because you shouldn't violate my rights anymore.
Well, first I would pose that that is an unreal type of situation because there's always injury, is our position, when these rights are violated. But for purpose of the hypothetical, I would analogize it to libel per se, where there is a conclusive presumption of some injury, which, of course, can be mitigated by such a showing.
Yet in libel per se, a jury can return a verdict for $1.
I believe that might be contrary to what the rule is for libel per se. May return it, but I think that
you think that
he might be entitled to more damages.
Do you think that couldn't be upheld on appeal under the normal rules of libel?
I think it might well not be, yes, under the normal rules, where there's a conclusive presumption of some injury. Now, it is possible.
Well, I thought he said $1.
Dollar's worth, yes.
Well, that would be nominal.
Well,
substantial compensatory injury.
Well, in that Quentin Reynolds case a long time ago, 15, 20 years ago, the jury, as I recall, returned a verdict of $1 actual damages and $75,000 punitive damages.
In that case, if there were substantial evidence mitigating the conclusive presumption of damages, then it could be reduced. Now, to $1, I'm not sure, because that would conflict in this case with the deterrent policies of Congress.
Mr. Elson, in this very case, assuming no willful misconduct by the defendant and just the facts that you have, what do you regard as the dollar value of the damages to which your client is entitled?
If I were a juror?
Yes. Or what are you going to ask the jury to give you in this case?
I'm not really positive. I think in the nature of between $500 and $1,000, possibly. I really haven't given it.
Your complaint requested $5,000.
One of the complaints did. One requested $3,000. That was at a time when punitives were also asked for.
Well, the amended complaint purports to be a class action complaint in the name of Briscoe.
It was originally filed as a class action. No class was certified.
No class was certified.
Yes.
But does that mean that Briscoe is the only party before us?
No, these are consolidated cases. In the district court with two students.
So you've asked $5,000 for one and $3,000 for the other?
Yes. At the time.
What's the difference?
Well, they were represented by different attorneys, I guess, who valued the amount of different amounts. But there are differences in the fact situations, of course, which may justify the juries coming up with different awards of damages. There were First Amendment protected interests implicated in the Briscoe case. Not implicated in the pipe.
But those damages also assume some injury from the suspension, a wrongful suspension.
Yes, that would be. But the injury that would be presumed from the violation itself would not be the same for all plaintiffs
exactly.
Across the board.
But and you think that you think the possibility of having a plaintiff securing attorney's fees wouldn't be enough of a deterrent to defendants?
No, not necessarily. There is no incentive for plaintiffs to file suits in order to pay off an attorney. There's the removal of a disincentive in that they might
Mr. Elson,
yes.
The record will show that there are several cases of libel per se with $1 damages that have been upheld.
Well, perhaps I was in error.
I know of one in particular in New York where one diamond merchant called the other one a thief. Mm-hmm. And he sued. And the jury came in and said, could we give the defendant damages?
Well, perhaps.
And when the judge told him no, they brought in $1.
The point to that, however, is that the... Yes.
Go ahead and respond.
That the law presumes conclusively that some damages have occurred, and in rebuttal, certainly, in mitigation, those damages can be lowered to a minimal amount.
You're not claiming that this deprivation of Ed in your complaint was a result of malice, are you?
No. Oh, in the complaint, it makes a claim for malice, but that wasn't proved, and that's not an issue.
Right. The district court found no malice.
That's right.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. The case is submitted.